to speak about the river of life, the river of change. And it's about impermanence, but not just about impermanence. It's about the infinite immensity of impermanence. So when I was in my 20s, I was inspired by a book by Hermann Hesse called Siddhartha. Probably a lot of you have read that book or heard of that book. How many of you are familiar with that? A lot of you, yeah. So I've forgotten the details, really, of it. People come up to me and say, oh, that's what your name, you were named after somebody in that book, Kamala. But Manindra named me Kamala, but he didn't know about that book at all. So much of the book was beautiful, but what remains is an image when I was reading that book about Siddhartha sitting next to the river, the always moving, always changing river, and the flowing of the water, and the sense, and whatever the words were, the description was of not being able to stop that flow, that leaves were going by, changes were happening, pebbles were being moved, the soil underneath, of course, wasn't staying the same, the temperatures were changing depending upon the sun or the lack of it, etc. And it was a great teaching, opening my own sense doors and realizing that in present moment time, bringing me to present moment time and opening to how everything around is constantly changing, and yet somehow there is this experience all around us and within us, but there is this kind of underlying belief that we can stop it or that we can make it be different than it really is, when all these conditions are so strongly happening actually on their own. There's no one outside or inside deeming it so. And so somehow that flow of experience and that fluxing nature of life began an understanding for me that I didn't have before. At that time I was in my 20s, and so that understanding started to grow. So this, not last year, but the year before, I want to tell you a story about a walk that I did where I re-experienced that kind of fluxing nature of life. In 2014, I did the Camino de Santiago, that walk in Spain, but it does come from other countries. It's about a 1,000-year-old walk, and it's a very ancient pilgrimage for, it has been for countless people from that time, 1,000 years ago or more, from all different places. I met people who walked out of their front door in Germany and walked down to Santiago, taking some routes and then connecting up with the French route, and other people too. I didn't walk, most of the walks are about 500 miles, except when they're from another country, but I didn't walk that far, but I had 2 weeks, so I walked 200 miles, and that was far enough for me. So when I was walking, it was really a rough journey in a way, physically. There were places to, hills and kind of, not tall mountains, but mountains to climb, and places where it would be very steep. And the inside too, it wasn't an easy journey for me, but I thought it was a time when I wanted to get back to just the simplicity of life and to be able to connect with the pace of nature instead of the pace of cars or planes or trains, but just the pace of like walking on the earth. Like, how would that be? So there was, during that time, there was walking of about 11 to maybe up to 25 miles a day. That was a lot for, you know, I'm a walker, but not that much so. And there was heat and rain and inclines that were really steep and slippery slopes and all of that. A lot of villages and countryside and forest. And my companion and I had a wonderful Buddhist nun companion, And she was a great navigator. And we followed along a lot of streams and rivers. And it was a beautiful connection to the kind of pace of nature for me, instead of the fast pace of life. And I really had a time of going inward more. And it was more of an inward time for me. A lot of times at the beginning of the day, she would say, we'd be in some village, and she'd say, Kamala, look over there. You can see this hillside with a tower on top of it, and then you can see a hillside beyond that. And you see those kind of little village up there? That's where we're going. And I said, you mean we're going to get there from here to there today? And she said, yeah, that's where the next place is that we're going to stay. And I just couldn't believe it. I'd say, I can only do one step at a time, so don't scare me. I'm just going to do this step and that step, and then we're going to get there. And of course, we're going to stop for a couple of cappuccinos along the way, and that's going to be even better. So that's how we did it. And then when we'd get there, you know, we'd be at the top of that place, the little village, and then there were places that we could do this and look back, and she'd say, now look back. I want you to see how far you walked, because you should know that you can do this, and you did it one step at a time. Now, this nun that I know, she's a trekker. She treks in Nepal and places like that, so I've never done that before. So she was a great teacher for me and a great inspiring person for me, that she would point that out. And she would constantly let me know that this body mind can go far. And even though we don't think so, it can go far, just taking one step at a time. So during that time, wanting to be in the natural, in a sync with the natural rhythms of my own body, and connecting with forests and lakes and waters, and not being in the concept of time so much. You know, when you're in the present moment, you're just walking, and the concept of time doesn't exist very much. And when there was walking along like a forest path, there might be just the smelling of leaves that have fallen, that are doing their, you know, disintegrating thing. And there would just be noticing the smelling, and just being aware of that. Noticing the crunch, 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 the hearing below my feet, and just noticing hearing or feeling the foot on the ground. And then there'd be, you know, looking ahead, but looking around a little bit and noticing seeing. And it was really simple. I tried to do my practice in that walking where I wasn't trying to look at every single plant or notice, you know, the beauty of the sparkling water. I just kept it really close by. It's just seeing. It's just feeling the step on the ground. It's just smelling. It's just hearing. Simple things like that. And the constant change of everything. I mean, even in seeing, it's just change, a kaleidoscope. If, you know the kaleidoscopes, you put something up to your eyes and you twist this thing and it's constantly changing shapes and colors. Well, when you're not trying to be in the object of what is being seen, it just seems like that. It's just a kaleidoscope of shapes and colors coming and going, and it's not kind of getting locked in out there. It's just being really close to the seeing in here. And the same with hearing. Going next to rushing rivers sometimes, you know, I could understand intellectually and in a natural way how the waters were going through, like going over rocks or kind of passing through places that were kind of barriered, and you would hear the different sounds coming from water. And you kind of know that, but just stay really close to hearing, that's all. Just hearing, even though there would be kind of this mind and wonder at everything that was happening in that changing moment. Just knowing the constant change and listening deeply to the teachings that path, that walk was giving. The forests and the rivers and the hearing and the sensing and the moving water and the forming and bursting of empty bubbles on the water. So just as I could easily open my heart and mind to the naturalness of all that flowing onness, I could open to that in myself too, that endless process that's happening in what is called nature here in this body-mind continuum that's constantly interchanging information with one another and constantly changing and flowing and shifting. This endless process is always happening here too. So the river of life, which is this body and mind manifesting, these five sense doors that I've been talking about for the couple of days, and this mind door, it's always exchanging information and changing. No moment is ever the same. They say about snowflakes like that. Also, no moment is ever the same. There's so many combinations of life that happen. This is says a lot about that by David White, a favorite poet of mine, and he walked the Camino. So he has several poems on this, and this is called Camino, which means, it could mean the way, or it could mean the road. The way forward, the way between things, the way already walked before you, the path disappearing and reappearing even as a ground gave way beneath you, the grief apparent only in the moment of forgetting, then the river, the mountain, the lifting song of the skylark inviting you over the rain-filled pass when your legs had given up. And that poem goes on and on, just read the first part of it, but it's like that, you know. It feels like the ground gives way underneath you and you're just kind of floating for a while, and then it comes up to greet you, and then you feel in grief, and then you hear a bird and your mood just totally changes. And you can see that, the fickleness of the mind moment to moment, depending on outer conditions all the time. And I've been knowing that for a long, long time now, understanding that even in deep, on deep levels. And it brings a great deal of relief to the mind that there's a deeper understanding. But as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't take all the grief away. You know, there's still sadness sometimes for the grief. There's still longing. But it doesn't have a huge, huge grip like it did maybe 20 years ago or 30 years ago. The grip is lessened somewhat. So in recent years, I've been tuning into that immensity and infinity of time as a process that happens even to a human being, or in this cycles of life as a human being, this repeated cycle of birth and life and death and rebirth. I mean, some of us can think of it that way because, I don't know, somehow it's in our DNA to understand it as it's not just this one life, but there's other lives before this that this particular consciousness or mind experienced. And not only that, it's not even just other lives, it could be other world cycles. So it's so infinite. But sometimes we can only think of it in terms of this life, you know, how much moments arise and pass away, and how, you know, when we look back when we were younger, where is that now? You know, it's just, it's part of a life that was born, it lived out its time, and it died. The infancy, the growing into the, you know, years before teenage years and then into adult years, and now it's this time in my life, more the autumn of my life. Or who knows, you know, tomorrow I could die. So either whether you think about it in this life or in a very endless, repeated, long-term cycle, it's called samsara. And one definition of samsara is perpetually wandering through states of existence. Now, just today, how many states of existence have we been in? Like the morning time, you know, and then going through the sluggishness, like right now, after lunch, and then the times when we felt perky, and times when we felt like giving up, and times when we were wondering, why am I in this building? I should be outside, you know. It's like that. So perpetually wandering through states of existence, the endless cycle of eternally becoming, birth, life's changes, death, and rebirth. So I've been reflecting, how long has it been flowing and fluctuating on and on? This reflection has been going on for quite a while now. The infinite immensity of impermanence. And sometimes when I learn about, in the Buddhist cosmology, there's many layers of existence, and there's also world cycles. So there's at least, I mean, we know, and we are being receiving the legacy of the Buddha's lifetime and his understanding and his teaching. But that's only one of the Buddhas. We are living through the world cycle of this particular Gautama Buddha. But there have been other Buddhas, at least 30 plus other Buddhas, you know, of different world cycles. And during every Buddha's time, there was somebody that rose up during that time period and was inspired and said, I too have the intention to become a Buddha. And so then that Buddha died away, and then this Buddha, to be, with the intention, went through all his own life cycles or her own life cycles to be fully and deeply and profoundly realized, so that then that Buddha could go on. So this has been happening. I think I have a compendium of all those Buddhas at home. I think it's 34 or 36 of them, and all tell their lifetimes, and who knows. Anyway, it's interesting to let your mind kind of go that far out into the possibility of that. So reflecting on the joys and sorrows and pains and pleasures of life, how much needs to happen before we're fed up with it? How much needs to happen before we know that this is endless, before we realize that, and we finally start to surrender to seeing more deeply into life, instead of trying to get all the things or get rid of all the things we like or we don't like, or to change what we like or we don't like. The Buddha said, life is swept along, next to nothing its span. For one swept to old age, no shelters exist. Perceiving this danger in death, one should drop the world's bait and look for peace. So perceiving this danger in death, one should drop the world's bait and look for peace. So we, in the teachings that were given, it's like we want to learn this sooner, not wait till the end of life before, you know, we don't have much time to really practice. So now we have the time to practice. We've been given this precious body and this precious life, even no matter what challenges we have in the body or in the mind, it's still precious to live through this life and use this life instead of, you know, not using it to, for our good, for the benefit of others. So realizing this has given me an increased sense of urgency. I remember having this urgency when I was younger, and it's grown more since I've grown older. And this urgency is called samvega. I think I mentioned it in the first night. It's a Pali term meaning spiritual urgency, this urgency to be released, really released, totally released from suffering. And it takes a process to go through that. It takes really understanding deeply to go through it. It needs to be balanced with what's called pasada, a clarity and serene confidence that one can go through this. So we can have the sense of urgency to escape, But if we don't have the balance, the deep balance within, that it takes time. We just have to surrender to the law of how it unfolds. It may take more than one lifetime, but we're on our way. We're really on our way. We're doing it. We're being it in our life right now. And when Manindra would sense that I didn't have this pasada, he would say something like, when the fruit is ripe, it will fall from the tree. There's no hurry. You know, it's like we're trying to hurry up nature when we're doing that, when we're trying to kind of like pick the mango before it's really ripe. So we need to really have that sense of clarity and serene confidence that we're doing the best we can. Things are unfolding in the way they need to unfold. It couldn't be otherwise. So that allows one to proceed confidently towards the goal of liberation without lapsing into despair. Because when we lapse into despair, it's really important to know this when we lapse into this place of I can't do it, or I'm not good enough, or I can't do it because of this and that, because it doesn't help us stay as buoyant as we can on the path. So when we're doing that, it's really helpful to, I go into that too sometimes, not so much now, but earlier in my days of practicing, I would think, I can't do this. There'd be these certain times of, they call in the process, I like to call it the process of insight rather than the progress of insight, where, you know, it's rolling up the mat time. And I went through it just like they said it would happen. You know, when it got to a certain point, it was like, I'm going home. You know, I'm not going to go through this anymore. And it takes somebody to be there to say, you can do it. You just have to keep putting one foot in front of the other, one breath at a time, one experience after another. So reflecting on the infinite rounds of joys and sorrows and the endless rounds of existence and my limitations, you know, and sort of kind of balancing out the infiniteness of it, the infinity of it, and also knowing this moment of it, you know, where can I be with it so that I'm not giving up in this moment, or I'm not saying it's too much for me to see the infinity, but where is the middle ground for me? A lot of times I would listen to talks like this about things that are kind of far out. When I read you some of the suttas, they might be kind of far out for you. But when I was younger, I listened to Dhamma talks and they were beyond my capacity to really understand them and to comprehend what was always being assured. Like, if you just keep going, it will be fine. You know, if you just take one step at a time, all of that. But Manindra used to say, just take it in and let it sit there in your heart mind, in your heart. And when it comes time, that will, it will connect with actual experience. And then you'll know, okay, that teaching was there all this time. When it comes up, it will meet and there will be an opening that would be really incredible. I remember once I went to a retreat when I was, this was maybe in my early 30s, and there was a retreat being taught by someone who was very new in the Dharma. And this person was giving a talk on the five aggregates. And so the five aggregates are those component parts that make up what we call self, sense of self. And when there are various parts that are comprised of this, like body and mind parts, we can be attached to. So we can cling to any one of those parts as being me, mine, or who I am, or any one of those parts coming together, several of those parts coming together and kind of forming an idea that this is who I am, this is me, this makes up this woman or Kamala or this whatever it is I'm going through, and puts a self around it. And so at that time, I must have heard that talk a few times at least, and I had no idea what anybody was talking about. But the time was really ripe, and here was this new person almost just saying it, you know, by reading it. And all of a sudden, everything came together during that time for me, and it was like I really could understand in a way that was much more profound than ever before the selfless nature of this body and mind. And it was like not expected. It was because I wasn't grasping to know anything or to... It was just because of allowing the practice to unfold, allowing things to unfold in the way that they do, and not being picky about it should be this way or that way, but just having it do what it does and being aware of it. And then when the teaching came forth, then there was really that understanding, this is anatta. There was some understanding of anatta. Actually radically understood it than I ever did before. And that was the first time. There were other times of understanding anatta also, that uncontrollable nature of this mind-body continuum. So I'm going to read some suttas that talk about the undiscoverable beginning, where there's just this changing nature at every level. And these words of the Buddha give us a sense of what is beyond the concept of what we know of as time, and understanding the cycle of birth, life, and death as happening infinitely. I mean, our minds just seem to take in this, maybe just this life, but when we open our minds, it's a way of opening to something greater than we can understand. And that, even if you can't take what these words are saying, just opening to something greater than you could ever understand will help in the practice, because sometimes we can't even believe that there can be some kind of release or relief from suffering. And there can be. There can be. There is a saying about, you know, when there is a deep understanding of suffering, there doesn't have to be a me wrapped around it. The saying is, there is suffering, but no one who suffers. Have you ever heard that? There is suffering, but no one who suffers. And so that's when I say to you, yeah, it's really hard. I see dukkha. I feel dukkha. I realize dukkha. But there's a deep understanding that there's no one who is wrapped around it with some solid sense of self. It's just all these moving parts happening all the time. So a Brahmin asked, a certain kind of class of person in India, more the educated, sometimes they're educated in the spiritual realms, asked the Buddha, how many eons have elapsed and gone by in terms of wandering in this cycle of samsara? Is it possible to give a simile? So before I give the answer, the Buddha's answer, I want to explain in Buddhist terms what an eon is. An eon is an immeasurably long time. In Buddhist cosmology, an eon is called a kalpa. Maybe some of you have heard those words from reading suttas, a kalpa. And a kalpa is 4.32 billion years. Now, I don't know how they ever came up with that number, but anyway, I looked that up in a Buddhist dictionary. In astronomy, one eon is 100,000 million years. So it's a long time. So this Brahmin is asking the Buddha, how many eons have elapsed and gone by in terms of wandering in this cycle of samsara, like as human beings? And the Buddha answered, it is possible, Brahmin. It is possible to know, to understand. Consider the grains of sand between the point where the river Ganges originates and the point where it enters the great ocean. The eons that have elapsed and gone by are even more numerous than that. It is not easy to count them and to say that they are so many eons, or so many hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of eons. For what reason? Because, Brahman, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It is time enough to be liberated from them. And that ending part, it's always like a question to me. I always have to pause, because it's always like the Buddha's talking to me and saying, isn't it time enough to be liberated from them? I feel like he's right there in front of me saying, isn't it your time? Isn't it time enough to be liberated? So on another occasion, whilst dwelling in Savatthi, the Blessed One said, Bhikkhus, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Whenever you see anyone in misfortune, in misery, whenever you see anyone happy and fortunate, you can conclude, we too have experienced the same thing in this long course. For what reason? Because, bhikkhus, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It is enough time to be liberated from them. It is not easy, bhikkhus, to find a being who in this long course has not previously been your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter. For what reason? Because, bhikkhus, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It is enough time to be liberated from them. And the last one is something that really touches me. What do you think, bhikkhus, the Buddha said, which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable? Which is more, this or the water in the four great oceans? And the bhikkhus said, as bhikkhus are the monks who lived during that time around the Buddha, as we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the stream of tears that we have shed as we have roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. And the Buddha said, good, good, bhikkhus, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught in such a way. So in this in these particular suttas, there are a number of these, I don't know, 4, 6, or 10 in the Book of Causation that tells about this infinity and immeasurableness of these world cycles and samsara. So the fluctuations of just one life, birth, death, infancy, childhood, etc., that's enough. I mean, we could probably fill a bathtub if not more with our tears there. But it just slips through our fingers, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems like in my own life, life has changed so much along the way since I was born in the Philippines and came to America and lived in various places, and certain things happened in my life. It seems like I've gone through many lifetimes in a way, a lot of kind of vast changes in my karma, so to say, in the way life or karma has given me to face. So when I was in my 20s, the end of the river was not something I thought about. It was just too busy having children, raising them, being in survival mode. And even though I had a lot of interest and a sense of urgency to understand the deeper meaning of life, I did that, I did my best, and at the same time, I was busy. But now, like most of you in this room, we're of an age where we're more like in the autumn times of our life, and thank goodness there are some of you younger here who can take over and clean up the world somehow, hopefully. most of my life is behind me now, and there's not very much in front of me. If I'm lucky, maybe I have 20 more years or 30 more years, maybe. And there is a natural organic arising of the reflection on aging and death. And a lot of us are going through that now. The preciousness of life, of this human birth and life. And I thought now in these times, you know, in the last years of my life, I thought if I could have only realized that earlier, you know, I would have, I know I've been quite an ardent yogi anyway, but I might have even, I might have even been better off now if I could have used that earlier in my life. But I don't have a lot of regrets about, I don't look back and worry much about that I didn't do the right thing. I just did what I did. And I did the best I could. So I try to keep the truth of impermanence in the forefront of my mind a lot. And so it helps me to see everything as kind of like flowing by. And when I don't see things that way, I suffer. Not long ago, I did some practice in Lumbini, in the birthplace of the Buddha, with one of my teacher's monks, Sayadaw Vivekananda, Uvivekananda. And I usually don't bring any reading material. But on this time when I was there, I brought one piece of reading material, something that really inspires me. It's by Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. He's a great Tibetan teacher. And his words have inspired me a lot through the last years. Because his words bring together that sense of spiritual urgency and the recognition and the reminding me of the preciousness of life. So these are quotes from him. I just read these two passages every day, two different ones, so I hope I can channel the purity of his strength and intention to you, because from him it's much greater intention in there. So in the morning, I would read, "Ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants of this planet have any idea of how rare it is to have been born as a human being? How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using that chance to practice the Dharma? How many of those who think of practice actually do? How many of those who start continue? How many of those who continue really attain ultimate realization? Indeed, those who attain ultimate realization compared to those who do not are as few as the stars you can see at daybreak. As long as you fail to recognize the true value of human existence, you will fritter your life away in futile activity and distraction. When life comes all too soon to its inevitable end, you will not have achieved anything worthwhile at all. But once you really see the unique opportunity that human life can bring, you will definitely direct all your energy into reaping its true worth by putting the Dharma into practice." And at the end of the day, "Just as every single thing is always moving inexorably closer to its ultimate dissolution, so also your own life, like a burning butter lamp, will soon be consumed. It would be foolish to think you can finish all your work and then retire to spend the later stages of your life practicing the Dharma. Can you be certain that you will live that long? Does death not strike the young as well as the old? No matter what you are doing, therefore, remember death and keep your mind focused on the Dharma." So strong words to, I mean, get to the pith of life. The Pali word for this infinity and immeasurability of impermanence is anicca. And a lot of you are familiar with that word. The subtleties of it include the moment-to-moment arising, changing, becoming different, becoming otherwise, disappearing, never staying the same, subject to change, decaying. In a bigger way, it is realized as a continual flowing onness of life, the beginningless, endless river, emerging from innumerable conditions, not just a few, but innumerable, and one thing connecting to another, to another, to another, to another, fluxing, changing, moving, evaporating into different forms, recycling back. Rain, humidity, snow, hail, falling into the earth, forming rivers, waters, and then evaporating in this continual recycling. So Gyal Rinpoche says, there would be no chance at all of getting to know death if it happened only once. But fortunately, life is nothing but a continual dance of birth and death, a dance of change. Every time I hear the rush of a mountain stream or waves crashing on the shore or my own heartbeat, I hear the sound of impermanence. These changes, these small deaths, are living links with death. They are death's pulses, death's heartbeat, prompting us to let go of all the things we cling to. So there's a depth we can go to with this teaching from nature. Of course, you know, there are times in nature when we love it, we feel the delight, the comfort, the peace, you know, the wonder, the awe of nature. But when we can just turn our attention to that it's changing all the time, that's a whole different level of experience. Both of them are important. But if we're only turning to what's comfortable and not letting our attention turn to like what's uncomfortable, like change, then we're never going to live a real complete life. We're just living where in the comfort zone of life, always looking for that. So recently, when I was at IMS this last fall, Insight Meditation Society, I was teaching the first half of the 3-month course. It's probably one of the most favored regions on the planet to appreciate the changing colors. And that was a time when people say, oh, the leaves aren't going to change very much this time because there were certain conditions of like less rain or more wind or less, I couldn't figure it out. But anyway, they were saying all this, but it turned out to be one of the most beautiful times of nature in New England. And people were saying at the post office and at the local stores, we haven't remembered it being beautiful, this beautiful, since we've lived here. And it was like, wow, that was really something. And so I remember a time when I first went there back in the 90s, and I went there during the 3-month course. And so I was going on a trip around New England and looking at all the places where the leaves changed, and going away from this place where IMS is, Barre, Massachusetts, and we're looking for all these beautiful places all around New England, you know. And then there was some place when we were way up north, quite a bit up north, and we picked up this paper and it said, this one place was voted the most beautiful place in New England where you could see autumn. And we had gone all this far away, and it said Barre, Massachusetts. And it's just like how we are as human beings. We're always looking for the best of this, the beauty of that nature. Then, you know, and then you read, it's where you left. It was really, I'll never forget that, you know, picking up that paper and say, why are we all out here, you know? We could just be in this one place. But it happened that I stayed there this time and really enjoyed the fall colors, and this time just also enjoyed, you know, when the leaves were falling, and just like the poem says, when there's one Basho poem or something, just just seeing how easily the leaf just releases itself from the tree and just falls, and just appreciating the beauty of that, of the nature of that too. You know, that moment or moments of letting go, they don't have to be painful. They can be actually relieving. So we come to this practice to understand the nature of our life more deeply, to experience it in a way that may liberate us from the causes of suffering and from avoiding being in uncomfortable zones, you know, avoiding, ignoring delusion, seeing things but not seeing it clearly. Mostly when we say that about delusion, it means seeing what's impermanent really, but saying that, oh, this is going to be permanent. Or seeing what is really impersonal and saying, it's really personal. Or seeing something and saying, deeming it to be, this is going to be forever satisfactory, but it's not. So that's really the kind of the most profound understanding of delusion. So we practice here to see the causes of suffering and not shy away from them. Because if not seen, they can't be relinquished. They're always, the habit patterns of feeding them are going on with a lot of ignorance and delusion, on and on and on. So that's why it's good, better to see them than not to see them, even though it's very uncomfortable to see them. We're learning that to hold on to what changes and can't last forever brings pain. I mean, sometimes we have to learn it from places that are so hard to learn it from. I mean, different conditions for different people. You know, sometimes people lose a career, and that's much more painful to them than losing their father, you know. And sometimes people can lose a child and or an animal friend, and that's more painful than, you know, losing a job or a partner. You know, so that we have certain Achilles heels that we have in our lives where that's where we're really learning. And that's where, you know, I say, oh, this is a place sometimes that I'm really, really, this is the deepest place that I'm learning this. And I can't deny that. So we can't control, we can't hang on to anything that's thinking that it's going to bring perennial happiness, because things change. And one of the last retreats I went to, somebody gave me this quote, said from Alan Watts, but I looked it up and I couldn't find it from that person. But from other things he said, I can believe that he said this. So the quote is, from the moment we're born, we're in a free fall. It doesn't help to hold on to anything, because everything else is also falling with you. Like, you know, we try to hold on to something and think that, oh, this is going to be still now, this is going to save me, this is, I'm going to live here in this place for forever now. But it's changing too. Even after many lessons, lifetimes, we keep looking for what is stable. We keep looking for what is going to give us that unchanging place where we can relax into. But it doesn't really exist in samsara. And so we get more and more used to it. So we end up using our energy to resist the unpleasant and to chase after the pleasant. That's another description of samsara. It's kind of this, we're on this treadmill, either running away from the unpleasant or running towards the pleasant. Until we come to this kind of practice which supports us in opening to it again and again and again. Opening to the component parts that make up disappointment or sorrow or sadness or grief. Opening up to the component parts that cause anger and frustration and impatience. So the teaching on anicca and the way to understand this experientially is something the Buddha pointed to as so highly important. Because from this understanding of anicca, both the other two characteristics, anatta and dukkha, anicca's impermanence, anatta's impersonal nature, and dukkha's unsatisfactory nature. But it's from anicca, the impermanent nature, that the impersonal nature can be known very clearly. Because if everything's changing and not staying static, then where is this self? And there's a lot more to it than that, but just that in a nutshell. And then if everything's changing and not staying static, where is this ultimate enduring satisfaction that we're chasing after? So it's from anicca that those other two, it kind of forms a pathway into the other two being realized. Although some people realize dukkha in and of itself and anatta in and of itself as well. But anicca is a powerful one because it leads to the others. So the practice of vipassana is aimed towards this experiential understanding. It means, vipassana means seeing or understanding in various profound ways. It's not just this everyday being mindfulness. It goes much deeper than just being mindful of walking or seeing. But in that walking or seeing, can we see the changing nature of it and be able to also understand how impersonal and unsatisfactory it is. Now, of course, there are a lot of beautiful, wonderful, happy moments, and they can become even more precious when we know that they live only so much time, most of the time just a short times. But if we can realize the preciousness of their short lives, it helps us to appreciate happiness more. So anicca brings about the fact of dukkha. Anicca brings about the fact of anatta. There was a time, it can happen in very simple ways too, because it's not this great big thing that, you know, boom, all of a sudden you've realized anicca. It actually can happen very gradually, but then there can be like a tipping point where it's realized so much over and over and over again that there comes a point when it goes into the area of like it could never be denied in any way. It's just so, the understanding becomes so true, not just on the level that maybe you realize it at that moment, but at deeper and deeper and deeper levels. By inference, it becomes very profound. And so this is a description of, it was a very simple time of my own practice when I was on Maui doing a retreat. In those days, you know, I was the registration, I was the advertising person, I was the cook at times, and I did all the organizing and I drove the teacher here and there, and then I became the yogi, and every once in a while I cooked. You know, I really started from the bottom up. So those days, I'd be so tired in my practice, you know, finally doing my practice. And one time I was walking down a pathway that is just a gravel road, really, and that was my walking practice. And I was just walking down the pathway, and there were these hibiscus trees to my left, and they're bushes, but these were like probably about 100 years old, because it was an old farm, and there were really tall trees. And a wind came and blew, and there were, once in a while, a wind would come, and this one blew, and I was just stepping, lifting, placing, stepping, lift, and the wind blew, and then it's turning and looking up, and then there was a movement of the leaves, and then one hibiscus flower just dropped to the ground. And the mind was so quiet and just looked at that, seeing, and then it just dropped to the ground. And then that tipping point of the realization of anicca was like, whoa. Oh my gosh, everything is just, I mean, it was beautiful to be in, but all of a sudden, the movement and the instability of life became a bit scary. You know, just that real instability of life. And so I walked fast to Manindra's room, and I went to Manindraji, and I said, everything's moving, but actually everything's falling apart. And actually, like, everything's actually decaying too. You know, because I've seen dukkha in that as well. Everything's fluxing. I mean, even the knowing of it is just it's just moving. It's just like one knowing after another. And it can't, how could it be this way? It just seems so solid, and now it's not so solid. And so Manindra was, as I was talking, I was sort of sitting next to that, him in this, and he was in this chair that leaned back a little, and he was leaning back, and as I was talking, his smile became bigger and bigger and bigger, because he realized that understanding of anicca was really happening in that moment, in a way that it never happened before. It wasn't intellectual. It wasn't just because I was repeating somebody's words. And so it was an experience that the mind was seeing, living. It was an experience that it was thinking about. And that comes about by just doing the practice. You know, people would ask me, well, how did you do this? And I said, I would always say when I was younger, well, I really had a lot of faith and trust, and I just took the instructions in as if I were a child, a young child. I just took the instructions in as if, you know, the mind was just so innocent, and said, okay, I would say, okay, I'll try this. And I just followed what they said. And so it was, I just took the most simple instructions and followed them. And that's all really we have to do, you know, this kind of sitting and walking. It sounds so boring sometimes, just be aware. But there's a lot that can happen in that profound awareness. So this was a development of wisdom. It was, you know, really just beginning to arise, and more arose from that in the time that has gone by. And it's still doing its thing, you know, it's still making strides in understanding. It was hard to go through that time, and after that time came long moments of, because of the guidance, long moments of equanimity, like long. It lasted probably a couple of years. And that's sometimes you can get on a kind of a plateau, because you realize, and then you keep understanding that with more and more peace. So one characteristic of it wasn't total equanimity, it was just going into equanimity more times than usual. So one characteristic of dukkha is described in the commentaries as oppression by the incessant origination and dissolution. And so that's how come it gets to be heavy sometimes to open to anicca, like, whew, you can't hold on to anything. It feels so oppressive. But actually, when you get used to that, it can be so freeing. So, yeah, we realize the vulnerability of life. I talked about that yesterday. And when we really realize that deeply, then life becomes precious. And we don't want to waste it, and we don't want to hurt anybody. And we don't want to hurt ourselves, so we do the best we can, and we honor life and each other. I came across this by Thich Nhat Hanh. It's so beautiful. You are here, I am here, and we will both die. Now, in this moment, we have this time together. So just honoring Stephen Levine in that moment. You know, he passed away a few days ago. He wrote Who Dies? And he did a lot, yeah, about teaching about grief and end of life and opening to that. So from this understanding of anicca, the understanding of dukkha becomes clearer. And also the understanding of not-self becomes clearer. Carlos Castaneda, from the teachings of Don Juan, he said, whenever the internal dialogue stops, the world collapses, the world of self. And the extraordinary facets of what comprises that self surface as though they had been kept heavily guarded by our words. So this is when, you know, that silence, we're not talking about it or describing it, but it's just a moment of hearing, of seeing, of sensing, of feeling. We don't have to wrap anything around that like, oh, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. So at Savatthi, the Buddha said to the bhikkhus again, and these are what I'm talking about here, what he's saying here is about all the five aggregates, what all the component parts of what make up this sense of self. Bhikkhus, form is impermanent. The cause and condition for the arising of form is also impermanent. As form has originated from what is impermanent, how could it be permanent? Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Volitional formations are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. The cause and condition for the arising of consciousness is also impermanent. As consciousness has originated from what is impermanent, how could that be permanent? Seeing this, one understands there is no more for this state of being. So in other words, one can't believe anymore in this kind of self with a capital S, or, you know, how it is kind of a solid form inside or outside or around us or any combination of that. Because everything is moving and changing. So in the text we have these particular words I just wrote recorded in different, slightly different ways, but it was recorded 159 times in different areas. Just repeating the impermanent nature of things with its causes that are also impermanent. And this one was from the Khanda Samyutta. So the understanding of direct knowledge opens the wisdom factor to experience all the other factors, the anicca, dukkha, anatta. Everything's evanescent, nothing is solid. And when I was at a recent retreat with Utejaniya, there was a person there. It was mostly it was organized by a Vietnamese monk, and so it was from his Vietnamese temple that a lot of people went. So it was a lovely retreat with a lot of Vietnamese cultural people around, and it was wonderful, and others too. And so there was this lovely young man, Vietnamese man, quite husky, and he was sitting on one of the chairs like this, just with his legs up in lotus position on the chair. And we had group interviews, but this one was an interview with the whole group, and there were maybe about 50 of us. And he said, Seadao, he said, I feel like I'm going crazy. Seadao means spiritual teacher. I feel like I'm going crazy. He said, everything in the body is fluctuating. That's what I thought was like something solid. It's just all, it's all, I think I'm crazy because everything's going haywire. It's going like this and that. And he said, you were crazy before. Now you're wise because you really see what's going on. And so the guy kind of stopped for a moment and wondered. And then Sayadaw Utejiniya explained to him, that's what the reality is. You're seeing into the nature of reality. So you didn't know before, and now you know. And I think if I would have said that to that young man, he would have, you know, poo-pooed me, but it was like Utejiniya saying it to him, so it was like he really felt at ease, you know, okay. And so the teacher was, you know, there to hold him in that. So we don't have to think about it. It just soaks into us in a way that it's like we're out in nature somewhere, and there's this kind of light rain, and we don't even know it, but we're getting soaked by wisdom, with wisdom and understanding as we do this practice. And then we learn to live naturally in alignment with the truth of change instead of resisting it. So I'd like to end with this beautiful saying by S.N. Goenka, one of the great Vipassana teachers of our time. He gave a lot of beautiful teachings and help to a lot of people, and it continues. Real wisdom is recognizing and accepting that every experience is impermanent. With this insight, you will not be overwhelmed by the ups and downs. And when you are able to maintain inner balance, you can choose to act in ways that create happiness for yourself and others. Living each moment happily with an equanimous mind, you will surely progress forward towards the ultimate goal of liberation from all suffering. So let's sit for a moment. Let those words dissolve.